Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Sometimes a player can be overshadowed by greatness, no matter how great they are themselves. Imagine playing on the New York Yankees at the time of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. That would have been a pretty hard lineup to be recognized in as one of the game's greats. Yet, players like Mark Koenig and Bob Musil, they did a pretty good job at being great. Or, how about playing in the shadows of Ty Cobb? Yet, Wahoo Sam Crawford, well, he did a pretty good job at being great himself. Now, imagine playing in the shadows of Rogers Hornsby. That's what Jim Bottomley did when he played first base for the St. Louis Cardinals. And on this episode of Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to talk about Jim's great career, a career that culminated with his election into baseball's Hall of Fame.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode number 130, Jim Bottomley. He played for the St. Louis Cardinals for 11 years, from 1922 through 1933. Chances are, though, most of you have never heard of Jim Bottomley. And that's understandable, considering he played for the Redbirds when Rogers Hornsby was winning Triple Crowns, when Rabbit Marinville was anchoring a standout infield, when Grover Alexander was experiencing a resurgence in his career. And yet, Bottomley just went about his business. During his 11 years as the Cardinals' first baseman, all Bottomley did was hit .325, belt 181 home runs, and knock in 1,105. 6 straight years, he had at least 100 RBI. Twice, he had at least 6 hits in one game. And on one occasion, he had 12 RBI in one single game. In 1928, he captured the National League MVP. And for all that, he is far from being at the top of anyone's list as one of the game's all-time greats. Yet, he was. He could really dig it out at first base. And in 1974, he was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame, an honor that was long overdue. Joining me on today's show is Kent Krause. Kent has put pen to paper many times, having written several books, including Sonny Jim Bottomley. And Kent and I are going to explore the career of Bottomley on today's episode. First, though, a couple of reminders. If you can, please leave a 5-star rating or write a review wherever it is you listen to Sports Forgotten Heroes. You can always follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on X, at Sports F Heroes, or follow on Facebook. And as always, thank you for your support. Okay, let's get straight into today's show with my guest, Kent Krause.
Kent, welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. So glad you could join.
Thank you. I am happy to be here.
Awesome. Hey, Jim Bottomley, where does your interest in Jim Bottomley stem from?
Well, I grew up in Iowa, and so I grew up kind of rooting for the Cardinals and the Royals. And I was also a baseball history fan. And I remember I got a baseball encyclopedia when I was a teenager. I just loved it. You know, those big, thick Macmillan volumes. Just could spend hours looking through all the numbers. And of course, Rogers Hornsby was one of the first guys I looked up. And then I'd look up the teams he played on, and I noticed this Jim Bottomley. It's like, wow, he was really good too. And so, I got interested in Jim Bottomley as for my past as a baseball history fan and a Cardinal fan.
Well, there you go. So for those who are not familiar with Jim Bottomley, summarize his career for us. Who was Jim Bottomley, and just how good was he?
Well, he broke into the majors in 1922. He's one of the first products of Branch Rickey's farm system, his newly created farm system. And he was the Cardinal first baseman for 11 seasons. Then he played five more seasons, three with the Reds and two with the Browns. His career in the majors ended in 1937. And he was the cleanup hitter for the Cardinals, a big RBI man. He drove in 100 RBI. He had 100 RBIs 6 years in a row, and nine times in his career he drove in more than 90 runs. So he was a foundational part of those first great Cardinal teams that emerged in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting question for you. How did the game work back in the 1920s? Was there a draft? How were players discovered, and how were they signed?
Well, they were discovered the old-fashioned way. I mean, they would have to be a scout. Scouts would travel the country. They would go to small towns. They would go wherever they thought a talented kid might be out on the field. And so that's kind of how Bottomley was found. Actually, if you want the story, there's four main points.
Well, that's where I'm going. That's okay. Actually where I'm going. If I follow the story correctly, Jim sort of pushed himself onto the St. Louis Cardinals and Branch Rickey, did he not? I mean, there's like three or four different stories, but maybe not one of them is entirely correct. But then if you take all three or four of them and mash them all together, that could possibly be how Jim was discovered. Can you take us through that?
Sure. Yeah, there are, like, I found four accounts of how Jim Bottomley makes it to the majors. And I kind of looked, I think there's truth to each of them. And I kind of put them in the order how I think they happened. And the first point was Branch Rickey gave a talk at the Nokomis High School. Nokomis is Jim Bottomley's hometown. It's a town in Illinois, about an hour northeast of St. Louis. And the principal there says, hey, we got this kid, Jim Bottomley. You got to check him out. Well, I imagine Branch Rickey would hear that all the time. And so I don't think that really did much for him, but it, you know, put the idea in his head. And so then later that summer, Jim Bottomley writes a letter to Cardinals management and says, I'm Jim Bottomley. I'm 19 years old. I love to play baseball, and presents this case that he's ready to be for a chance to play for the Cardinals. Well, fast forward to Labor Day. This is all in 1919. This is happening. Jim Bottomley's 19 years old. Well, on Labor Day, Jim Bottomley has a great day playing for a semi-pro team in the Nokomis area. He's actually playing for a team from Witt, which is nearby. And he hits two home runs, three triples, and this policeman witnesses this, and his policeman knows Branch Rickey, and so he tells Branch Rickey, hey, you got to check out this Bottomley kid. Well, by this time, Branch has heard enough. He sends his top scout, Charlie Barrett, to go check out Bottomley. He sends him to see some of his games, and Barrett says, yeah, this kid does have some talent. So they invite Bottomley to a tryout in St. Louis, and this is at the end of the season. He goes, takes the train to St. Louis, has his tryout, and doesn't go great at first, but then eventually both Rickey and Barrett see, yeah, this kid's got some talent. So they sign him for $150 a month to be in the Cardinals organization.
So he makes the card. He gets to the Cardinals. He signs with the team. Obviously, there's some minor league ball play and all that he's got to go through. He's got to work his way up through the system. When he did join the Cardinals, though, they weren't that good a ball team. I mean, we think of the Cardinals today as a team that is a really solid team. Even they might not win every year, but they always have a good farm system. They're always in contention. If not every year, every couple of years, they've won a few World Series over the last couple of decades. But they were pretty bad back then. And I guess Branch Rickey really didn't have anything to lose by signing Jim Bottomley, did he?
No. I mean, the Cardinals, like you say, they were a second division team through the first two decades of the 20th century, and they didn't have, they were among the poorest teams in the league, and they drew poor, you know, low attendance. And Branch Rickey comes in the late teens, and he has this idea to try and turn the team around. And but yeah, I mean, by signing Bottomley for $150 a month, there's really no risk. And but they really, the other important factor is Sam Braden comes in and buys a majority ownership of the Cardinals, and so that gives them a little more financial stability. So you have Rickey as he was the vice president and business manager, but he functioned as a GM. So I'm just going to call him the GM. And so he's got the ideas and then Breeden has the financial backing, and so that gives them the opportunity to start trying to build a contender in the early 20s.
Well, they had a really terrific ball player, one of the greatest of all time, to build that team around. That's Rogers Hornsby. And when Jim made the team, in reading your book, they became, I guess, somewhat close. How close were they, at least in the beginning?
Well, Hornsby didn't really have friends on the team, but he actually got along well with Bottomley, and maybe he got along as better with Bottomley than any other player on the team. So I can't go as far as to say they were buddies, that they hung out, but they got along. And Hornsby at times was kind of difficult to get along with. And so Jim later said that there was never a harsh word between us in their Cardinal years. I mean, things later on down the road, there was an issue, but in their Cardinal years, they got along really well. And I think Hornsby really, he wanted to win ball games. That was his main thing he wanted. And he recognized that Bottomley was a very talented ball player, and he respected his ability.
Yeah. One of the things about how talented a ball player Jim Bottomley was his defense. You know, a lot of times, I don't want to say teams hide players at first base, but they're not necessarily the most athletic on the team. They usually hit for power, and they hope they can catch and scoop a ball. But man, that's what Jim Bottomley could really do. Talk about his abilities, how good a defensive ball player Jim Bottomley was.
Well, that was one of the first things that Branch Rickey noticed about him at that tryout, is he said, boy, that kid could really stretch. He could really, you know, extend his glove, is what you want out of a first baseman. First basemen are usually tall, and so he could really stretch and get those potentially errant throws and scoop those in. And the other thing about Bottomley is he was fearless when going after foul pops towards the wall, and he diving over into the crowd. And so, yes, he was definitely a slick fielder. I mean, unfortunately, we don't have the footage. It would be wonderful to see him field, but the accounts in the press and other players would say that he was really good. He would save a lot of his infielders' errors, you know, with his abilities to scoop up throws.
He had power. He was a powerful guy. I mean, he was a big dude, could really launch the ball. In fact, his power was so prodigious, it actually got him into a little bit of trouble. He hit a home run, and the ball hit someone in the face, and that person, incredibly, sued Bottomley. Talk about that. And how important a precedent it wound up being when you take a look back at all the people who've been hit by foul balls or home runs or whatever during the course of the history of baseball, this was actually very unique and set a standard.
Yeah, the incident happened in June of 1925 when Bottomley's really coming into his own as a power hitter. And this is at Sportsman's Park, and this fan is in the right field bleachers, and Bottomley hits a home run. And apparently the fan wasn't able to catch it because it smashed him in the face and broke his nose. And so he does sue the Cardinals for $7,500, the Cardinals and Jim Bottomley. And he actually wins the first judgment. They only give him $3,500, but he wins the judgment. So
he being the person who got hit,
right? Irvin Hayes, he's a driver for Western Union. Yeah, the fan won the settlement, but the Cardinals appealed, and then on appeal, the decision is overturned. So that clears the Cardinals and Jim Bottomley. And in terms of precedent, oh my gosh, if it would have stood, if the initial decision would have stood and this man would have won his settlement, then all the teams would have, you know, there would have been, had to put nets up everywhere, and like, there could have been lawsuits all over the place. And I'm guessing this is when, not long after that, that's when those tickets start having that little fine print on there about you assume the risk.
And this wasn't something that was settled and appealed or settled and ruled upon in a matter of months. This took quite some time for this to work its way through the courts. How long did it take? And did it have any effect on Jim Bottomley?
Right. Yeah. The first decision came down a year after it happened. So it would have been the summer of 26. The first, and then as two years later, so it was actually a total of 3 years before it was finally resolved. But I didn't see any evidence that Bottomley was affected by this. I think he was able to just kind of put it out of his head and just play baseball and trust that the Cardinal lawyers would work their magic. But he doesn't seem to stress over it.
I love that you put that in the book. I love those little kinds of nuggets. It helps paint a good picture of what the game was like and how people were. And, you know, I just love talking about little nuggets like that. Here's a nugget, but it's a big nugget. Like we said, the Cardinals, they just were not that good a ball team. And they started to finally gain a little bit of momentum, and they were building and building towards something. And finally, they did build something. And at this point, Rogers Hornsby was a player manager for the team. And in spring training, I believe it was 1929, was it? Or was this 26? He basically guaranteed that the Cardinals would win the World Series that year. What made Rogers so confident in that team, and what kind of season did Jim Bottomley have to contribute to the Cardinals winning the World Series that year?
Well, yeah, that's the spring of 26. And one reason why Hornsby was so confident is he took over as player manager the previous season in late May. He coached for or managed for part of that season, and they were in last place when he took over, and under his direction, they were able to end up over 500 at the end of the year. They were one game over 500, and so that, you know, helped him, that increased his confidence. It increased the confidence of the other players and a lot of Cardinal fans, too, and they had all these pieces coming together. Bottomley, of course, is Bottomley and Hornsby are a potent 1-2 punch. Hornsby won the Triple Crown again in 1925. And so heading into 26, that's one thing about Hornsby is he wanted to win and he believed his team would win, and he didn't accept anything less than that kind of a commitment from his players. And his players, they liked playing for him. They believed in him. And so you ask about what Bottomley contributed in 26. He actually got off to a slow start in 26. He slumped, but then as the season went on, and especially in the second half, he got really hot. And he ends up leading the National League in RBI that year with 120. He leads the NL in doubles as well. And so he has a very productive year. He did end up batting .299 the first time he wasn't over 300. But, I mean, he was so productive. And, yeah, that got people's attention because batting average was so highly regarded back then. But in reality, he was a very productive hitter and a key contributor to that team's pennant drive.
Who was who were some of the other stars of the team at that time?
Well, you had Les Bell at third, and you had Billy Southworth, who came over in a trade. And Bob O'Farrell was the catcher. And then you had pitchers Jesse Haynes, and that was the year that the Cardinals traded for Grover Cleveland Alexander. Or excuse me, I'm wrong. They signed Grover Cleveland Alexander off of waivers mid-season. And so he became, Flint Ream was another one of their pitchers. And so yeah, you had this crew coming together, and that Branch Rickey had been building over several years.
And so Hornsby guarantees that they're going to win the World Series, and who are they playing? The Yankees, of course. Everybody played the Yankees in the World Series back then. They were the team to beat. And it looked like the Yankees were going to win that series, but somehow the Cardinals pulled it out. Tell us about that. Tell us a little bit about the World Series in 26.
Well, there were two evenly matched teams. I mean, the Yankees win Game 1 in Sportsman's Park, and then Grover Cleveland Alexander pitches a gem in Game 2 to even things up. The Cardinals take Game 3, and then in Game 4, Babe Ruth explodes with 3 home runs, and so it's even at 2-2. And then the Yankees win Game 5. Oh, I misspoke. Game 1 was at Yankee Stadium. I'm sorry. The first two games were at Yankee Stadium. Games 3, 4, and 5 were at Sportsman's Park. And then when the Cardinals lost Game 5 at Sportsman's Park, you know, they're down 3-2, and they have to go to New York. So it was not looking great. Hornsby was still confident. And Grover Cleveland Alexander pitches another gem in Game 6 to even things up. And then that sets up Game 7, one of the most dramatic World Series games ever, where the Cardinals are ahead 3-2 in the 7th. Jesse Haynes, the Cardinals starter, he's a knuckleballer. He develops a blister that breaks and he has a bloody finger. And so Hornsby brings in Grover Cleveland Alexander to relieve. And that's the famous situation where the Yankees have the bases loaded. Tony Lazzera is at the plate and Alexander strikes him out, but not before Lazzera hit a long foul ball that was only a few feet away from being a grand slam. And then how the series ends is another big story. Is in the 9th inning, it's still a one-run game. Babe Ruth is on first, and Alexander's still in there pitching. And he pitches the first pitch to the next batter, Bob Musil, Ruth takes off for second, hoping to catch everybody by surprise. And O'Farrell throws down to second. Hornsby puts on the tag, and the World Series ends right there with Babe Ruth getting tagged out at second.
What kind of series did Bottomley have? I mean, I see, you know, he played in 4 World Series over the course of his career, and this obviously, I think, was probably the best one. I see he hit .345, 10 hits and 29 at-bats, knocked in a couple. Tell us about his series.
Yeah, it was his best World Series of the 4, and he drove in the first Cardinal run in the first game. And, you know, if there was any nerves, it didn't show, because he's playing in Yankee Stadium and in front of a crowd of 60-some thousand. And so, yeah, he had a hit in every game. And he, I believe he drove in 5 runs. He scored 4. He scored a run in that pivotal Game 7. And so, yeah, and he didn't make an error. So he was solid production offensively and defensively in that first series. And it was a very close series, so it was all very important what he contributed.
Right. You know, you said it earlier, he was an RBI machine. I mean, in fact, from 1925 through 1929, he averaged 129 RBI a year. And in 1928, that's really when he put it all together. He won the MVP award with 31 dingers, 136 RBI, and he hit .325. During that period of time, who was better? Jim had to be about as good as anyone in the game, at least in the National League. Just how good was Jim Bottomley?
Well, yeah, in 1928, I think he was the best player in the National League. I mean, he comes up and he's an excellent player, but I mean, you got Roger Hornsby in the midst of batting 400 over a 5-year stretch. So it's pretty hard to top that. But yeah, by 28, he puts together that season and, you know, he's got over 40 doubles that year, 20 triples, 31 home runs. The only player to put up that kind of 40, 20, 30 club, to be in that 40, 20, 30 club. I mean, it's really hard for a guy to hit 20 home runs, 20 triples, and 30 home runs in the same season. And so, and then while he's also driving in 136 runs. So, yeah, I mean, he was at the top of his game then, and the voters recognized it by giving the MVP award.
But during that whole period from 25 to 29, they're really that 5-year period, that little stretch. I, you know, maybe Rogers Hornsby was better than he was, you know, at that point. But I don't know if there really was anyone better than Jim Bottomley in the National League. I mean, sure, you had Babe Ruth and, you know, Lou Gehrig over in the American League. Pretty tough to top those guys and say you're better. But in the National League, I mean, what Bottomley was doing, I mean, in 25, he hit, he hit 367, then he hit 299, 303, 325, 314. He had the power. And again, like an RBI machine, who would you think could have been better in the National League at that time? Was there somebody on the Giants or the Dodgers? Well, the Dodgers weren't even all that good at that time. The Brooklyn Robins, I guess maybe they were called back then. But who was better than Jim Bottomley?
Well, I think you're right. I don't think there was anybody better than him, because that 25 season, I mean, that's, I think, as good of a season as his 28 season. I mean, Rogers Hornsby would be in the conversation. He's not quite as good as he was earlier in his career. He did pull out an MVP in 1929. He was still very good. I mean, you got Hack Wilson coming on for the Cubs, who's a good ball player as well. But I think you're right that Bottomley was the best National League player from 25 to 29.
And that brings up my next question. How is a guy like Jim Bottomley so obscure when it comes to talking about the greats in the history of baseball? I mean, this guy, for a 5-year stretch, and really, if you think about it, even longer than that, but for a 5-year stretch, he was as good as anyone. Why is he, well, forgotten?
Well, I think multiple factors come into play here. One, he was on a team that had another player who grabbed more headlines, like Rogers Hornsby in the first half of his career. He was the headline grabber. And then later on in his career, there's Frankie Frisch. And then when he's at the end of his Cardinals career, when Bottomley's at the end of his Cardinals career, you have Dizzy Dean and you have Joe Medwick coming on. And so, and then the next chapter of Cardinals history is the Gas House Gang, the legendary Gas House Gang. And so I think as the years passed, you know, these other Hornsby, Dean, Medwick, the Gas House Gang, they occupied more of the collective memory. And then the other factor is Bottomley did not stir controversy. He was a nice guy.
He wasn't a flashy guy. He kept to himself.
Well, he had they noted that he had this strut and this swagger, and he was a laid-back, friendly guy. But he didn't, you know, come up, have these stories like Rogers Hornsby grabbed headlines not only for his hitting, but also his gambling, his horse, his bets at the horse track. And, you know, Dizzy Dean, you know, he was a colorful, flashy character, and the Fordham Flash, Frankie Frisch. And so, yeah, I mean, Bottomley's not out there stirring controversy, and he's certainly not like a Ty Cobb. You know, he didn't get into brawls and high profile incidents. And so I think that that's also a factor in how he could be forgotten as the decades passed. I mean, at the time he was highly respected as a stellar hitter, but I think those are the factors that play into his post-career, how he was forgotten.
Yeah, because you talk to baseball fans today and you say, Lou Gehrig, they know him. Rogers Hornsby, they know him. you know, Frankie Frisch, we've heard of Hack Wilson, you know, all these guys that you were talking about. But how about Jim Bottomley? Who? Yeah. He was such a good hitter. In fact, 1929, a year he called the worst of his career. To that point, he hit 314 with 29 home runs, and he set a National League record with his sixth straight season of at least 100 RBIs. He had 137. He also had 31 doubles and 12 triples, and he only struck out 54 times in 648 plate appearances. Man, that's an awful, awful season. I mean, that's the worst of your career. How good of a hitter was he? And outside of Hornsby, who was better?
Yeah, I don't think anybody. And that just shows, I think he was hard on himself. I mean, he did make that quote saying, I'm having the worst year of my career. I don't know what's the matter with me. And he puts up these monster numbers in 1929. And so, yeah, I think he was a victim of his own success. I mean, he had been so good for so long that people kind of took him for granted. And his owner, I think Sam Braden, took him for granted too. It was just like, if anything less than absolute stellar production ever went in any kind of a little slump, you know, they'd wonder, well, what's wrong with Bottomley?
Hey, I want to go back for a moment. 1926, as we said, Hornsby and Bottomley were pretty good friends. And Hornsby, like we said, led the Cardinals to the World Series win over the Yankees. And the Cardinals fired him. They got rid of Rogers Hornsby. They traded him away. They traded away their player manager. Why? And how did that affect Jim?
Well, what happened is the Cardinals were in the midst of a tight pennant race heading into September, and there were some off days where Sam Braden, the owner, had scheduled some exhibition games, like in Syracuse and Buffalo. And Hornsby thought, hey, it'd be nice if I could get my players some rest. You know, maybe we could cancel those exhibition games. And Braden wouldn't do it. I mean, he thought about it, but, you know, there's financial implications. The owners of the clubs, the minor league clubs in those towns, aren't going to like it. And so, unfortunately, Braden picked a bad time to go tell Hornsby the news. He went into the locker room between games of a doubleheader, and he said, this is how it's going to be. And Hornsby just exploded and yelled at Braden right in front of all the other players. And he told him where he could shove his exhibition games. And so, you know, Braden, you know, he couldn't tolerate that kind of insubordination from one of his highly paid employees. And so he was simmering. Hornsby was just, he couldn't understand why the owner wouldn't support him more. And he's trying to lead his team to a pennant. And so that's the main factors, the widening rift between Hornsby and Braden. There's also, Hornsby did like to place high value bets at the horse track, and Braden didn't like that either. And so even though the Cardinals won the World Series, Braden wanted to get rid of him. And so when Hornsby wanted 3 years at $50,000 for the next 3 years, and Braden offered him 1 year at $50,000. He wanted to get rid of him, but he wanted to make it look like he wasn't getting rid of him. He made an offer, and Hornsby rejected it. And so Braden immediately called the Giants, who had been wanting Hornsby for years. And since Braden was able to get Frankie Frisch out of the deal, he made the trade. Cardinal fans were horrified. They were just so angry. Can you imagine? Hornsby's the most popular guy in town. He's the manager and the star second baseman of their championship team. And so you ask about, the Cardinals fans were enraged, but Bottomley, he wasn't happy either. I don't think any of the players were happy about it, but I mean, he's, you know, it's just, you got to do what you got to do. He showed up at work the next spring training, as did the rest of the team. And it didn't really seem to affect him. He actually ended up becoming good friends with Frankie Frisch. And so it all worked out for Bottomley's career. But no, this wasn't a positive development for him when he learned the news that Hornsby had been traded.
Yeah, baseball obviously was much different then. And they played these exhibition games. The teams needed money. They didn't make money like they do today. Jim played his first 11 years with the Cardinals. Over the course of those 11 years, he hit 325, 181 home runs, and he knocked in 1,105 runs. Yet, after the 1929 season, that awful season we just talked about before, the worst of his career, through 1932, he was faced with trade rumors. And at one point, he said, even a trade might not be the worst thing. What gives? Why did Jim Bottomley, who doesn't cause trouble, who is a team guy, who performs and hits the heck out of the ball, fields the ball well, why did he fall out of favor with the Cardinals? What was wrong with his game? And maybe was it his performance in the postseason, the World Series of 28, 30, and 31, how much did that contribute?
Well, those are all factors. And I think one of the big factors is he got hurt in 1930, and he wasn't as great as he had been. He ends up batting, still bats 304 that year, but it's an injury-plagued year. He hurts his thumb early on, and that bothers him all year, you know, with gripping the bat. And he struggles a bit that year. Braden gets on him. He thinks he might be dogging it a bit. And he kind of turns on him. And the frustrations build. I mean, Bottomley knows he's not hitting like he used to. He has to deal with his owner issuing a few statements that, well, maybe Bottomley could be doing better. And so Bottomley issues that statement like, well, maybe I should just be on another team. And then, you know, Cardinal fans get wind of that. And so he actually gets booed at Sportsman's Park. I mean, the most popular guy on the team after that statement. Now, Bottomley did soon after that walk back his statements and say he wanted to play for the Cardinals. And then the Cardinals, by the way, were in a tough pennant race that year. They were actually way behind, but they charged ahead in August and September, and they won the pennant. And so that glossed over a lot of the tensions, and, you know, the fans love Bottomley again, but then he has that horrible World Series in 1930. He bats like, oh, whatever. He was like 1-for-22, I think. And so injury is plays a role in that. And then the Cardinals lose that World Series. And so then that kind of revs up the trade rumors again. And then the final factor that contributes to all this is the Cardinals have an up-and-coming first baseman named Ripper Collins. He's tearing it up in the minors. And that's Branch Rickey's MO is to take a established veteran, trade him away, and bring up the new young guy who costs a lot less. And that's how Bottomley got his break with the Cardinals. They traded away their veteran first baseman who was earning a lot more money and brought in the Jim Bottomley. They didn't have to pay very much too early on. Well, now Bottomley's the veteran who's making a good salary. And the idea, it's cold, but that's how they run the business, is get rid of the guy, try and get the same production for a much lower cost. And so that's why the trade rumors were, they started in 29, then 30, they were really strong. And I actually think they would have traded away Bottomley, but Ripper Collins had an injury, and so he wasn't quite ready to come up yet. And so they kept him on for 31, which worked out really well for Bottomley.
Mm-hmm. Well, he finally got traded. He went to Cincinnati, and he was somewhat excited to get there and start fresh, but it really didn't work out. Why?
Well, by the time he goes to Cincinnati, and that's after the 32 season, he has a great comeback year in 31, does really well, and the Cards win the series, but then 32 injuries set in, and Ripper Collins is in the major leagues by this point, and he is taking over first base, and he gets traded to Cincinnati, and by this time injuries are affecting Bottomley on an annual basis.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that, but please finish up this.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the key of what's happening at Cincinnati. He's not the same player he was, and he seemed to get hurt every year. And the other problem is Cincinnati at this point is a terrible team. And it's hard to drive in runs when your teammates aren't getting on base. So he's on a last place team. He's hurting, and he's not producing like he used to.
Well, but the thing about him injured and being hurt, that seems to me like that was a routine thing, particularly during spring training. It seemed like Jim Bottomley was hurt every spring training. He was always hurt.
Yeah.
What made him so fragile? Why was he always hurt in spring training? And, you know, obviously it would affect the start to his year every year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not 100% sure is the reason, but I would speculate that not playing baseball from October till the next March. I mean, he was very active in the winter months. He would hunt and he would fish, but he's not using the same baseball muscles. And so I think just showing up, and he's a guy who I don't know if he had the ability to do half speed. I mean, I think he would go all out, spring training game, charge after the foul ball, do whatever, and try and make the play. I know he got hurt his fingers a lot, so he's probably diving after throws. And so I think that's a factor. And maybe it's just a little bit of luck thrown in there too. But yeah, he just would always find himself hurt. But with the Cardinals, he usually got himself back into shape and got healthy again by the start of the season and was ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Where did the nickname Sonny Jim Bottomley come from?
Well, it's given to him because he's an amiable guy, a gregarious guy, a friendly guy that people want to be around, smiling, he's cheerful. And I wanted to know when it first got that name. And the earliest documented example I could find is when he's playing for Syracuse in 1922. So that's his third year in the minor leagues. He became Sonny Jim Bottomley, and that just carried over to when he came to St. Louis, and it's still with us today.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. How important was Nokomis to Jim Bottomley?
Oh, he loved his hometown. It was, he went back there every year, and he lived with his parents in Nokomis up until age 32 when he got married. And he would go there every year. They would have, just a couple weeks after the season, they would have Bottomley Roughing Day, because Red Ruffing, the Yankees pitcher, was also from that town. And they would celebrate him. Nokomis really knew how to celebrate a star player from there. And they would come and they would, what, townspeople by the hundred, you know, 100 townspeople would go to Sportsman's Park and watch Jim play on Nokomis Day at Sportsman's Park. So it was extremely important to him.
Now, I think that people like me and you who love baseball, who love the history of baseball, and there are so many people out there who are listening to this podcast or watching on YouTube who love baseball and know so much about the history of baseball. We know that at that time there were two teams in St. Louis. There were the St. Louis Cardinals and the St. Louis Browns. The Browns are now the Baltimore Orioles. They both played at the same ballpark, Sportsman Park. So if the Cardinals were home, the Browns couldn't be home. And if the Browns were home, the Cardinals couldn't be home. And I said, I love these little nuggets. And I can't remember the player's name, but you brought this up, that several players on the Cardinals and Browns, they shared a home. They shared an apartment. If the Cardinals were out of town, then it made sense for whomever your associate was on the Browns to share an apartment with. Was that something that only the Cardinals and Browns did, or did the Phillies and the Philadelphia Athletics, the Boston Red Sox and the Boston Braves, I don't know, the Yankees and the New York Giants, was this something that several teams did, or was this something that was really just unique to the Cardinals and the Browns?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm actually not aware of if the Athletics and the Phillies did that. I know it came about, the practice came about during the Great Depression when times were getting really tough. And so it was a great idea to save money. And Jim Bottomley, his counterpart on the Browns was a pitcher named Raleigh Stiles. And but yeah, that'd be an interesting thing to look up and find out. Did other teams with two teams in the same city do that as well? I mean, it made sense.
Sure. Well, Bottomley went from the Cardinals to the Reds, and then he found himself back in St. Louis, but with those St. Louis Browns. You know, and you said it before, that Rogers Hornsby, after he left the Cardinals, he tried to get Bottomley onto the teams that he was playing for, and it never worked out. But finally, Rogers Hornsby is the manager of the St. Louis Browns, and they get Jim Bottomley very late in his career, 1936. And again, like we said, the two were supposedly close, but there was a falling out. Worse, Rogers was the manager of the Browns, and he was fired, and Jim replaced him. How did that affect their relationship? And also tell us a little bit about Rogers' career with the Browns.
Well, Rogers Hornsby, surprisingly enough, the Cardinals bring him back in 1933, right when Bottomley goes to the Reds. But he doesn't play very long with them, and they let him go. But Branch Rickey recommends that the Browns hire him. And so he gets hired as player manager in 33, and he's still there in 36 when the Reds and Bottomley are both ready to part ways with each other. The Reds work out a trade. And Hornsby, like you say, he had been wanting to get Bottomley on his teams for several years. And so the trade is executed. They're teammates again, and there's all this excitement that they're going to revive the excitement of St. Louis from earlier years with the Cardinals. But, you know, this is the Browns, and they had a very weak pitching staff. They had some hitters, but they had a weak pitching staff in there, and through another, they're going through a tough season in 36. And Hornsby and Bottomley have a falling out. And Hornsby actually says he's ready to retire. He doesn't tell the press. They both try to keep this out of the press. Bottomley says it's my injuries that are causing this. But they smooth things over. They go through the season. And then in 37, Bottomley is a coach and a player for the Browns. But mid-season, the Browns ownership is tired of all the losses. And so they do fire Hornsby. And they replace him with Bottomley. Bottomley says at the dinner where they were saying, we're going to fire Hornsby and you're going to be our next manager. He says, oh, no, don't fire Rogers. But they say, well, we're firing him anyway, whether you take the job or not. So he says, all right. So he takes it. And you ask how it affected. I mean, Hornsby was not happy at all with this development. And he didn't get over it. I mean, he was not happy that with Bottomley. I don't know that Bottomley couldn't have done anything to save his job anyway, but I don't know that the two really spoke much after that. I mean, I think that was a rift between them, and so, although I will say this, that Bottomley never spoke ill of Hornsby in the press. He said he was a great manager. He said, you know, years later they would even ask, who's the greatest right-handed hitter of all time? And he would say, Rogers Hornsby. So mm-hmm. Bottomley never let any kind of ill will or bitterness, and I don't think he held ill will or bitterness towards Hornsby. Well, he wasn't that kind of a guy, but yeah, I don't know that they had much of a relationship after 1937.
Yeah. And Bottomley didn't make it much longer after that either. That was it for him in 37. He hit .239 for the Browns, had a home run, 12 RBIs, and he called it quits. For his career, Jim Bottomley hit .310, hit 219 home runs, and overall 1,422 RBIs. One of the things that we haven't really discussed were these individual game achievements. Some of the things that Jim Bottomley did during the course of his career, 12 RBI in one single game. He's one of only three players to have six hits in a game twice in their career. MVP in 1920 time. Nine times he drove in more than 90 runs in a season, including the six straight where he hit, where he knocked in over 100. Then you look at some of the numbers compared to other Hall of Famers. His .310 career batting average, higher than Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle. His career number of RBI, 1,422, more than Orlando Cepeda, Johnny Mize, Hank Greenberg. These are phenomenal numbers. And yet, when it came time for the Hall of Fame to elect Jim Bottomley, he kept getting passed over and passed over and passed over. Why? What was the knock against Jim Bottomley?
Well, I think part of it is what we talked about earlier, is that why he was forgotten. I think he was overshadowed by other higher profile players from his era. And I think another thing that hurt him that we didn't talk about is he finished, his last really good year was 1931. And then he was traded to the Reds, or three, he's languishing in a last place team there, and then languishing with the Browns for the last 5 years of his career. He still actually has some decent production, especially with the Browns in 36. But I think that kind of contributed to his being forgotten or easily passed over. And the other factor is the writers had really high standards for letting, for voting people into the Hall of Fame. And in the, especially in the 40s. And I mean, Rogers Hornsby didn't even get into like his fourth try. So you have that factor. And then they set the rule that you can, the writers aren't going to consider anybody who has played more than 20 years earlier. And so by 57, Bottomley's not able to appear on a writer's ballot anymore. And so yeah, as far as what the knock is, I'm not entirely sure what the knock was against Jim Bottomley. I mean, maybe he didn't play as long as some other guys, but I mean, he played 16 years. So.
He compiled the numbers. And it wasn't like he was, when I say compile the numbers, he had the numbers. He wasn't a compiler. He did most of the damage over a 7 or 8 year period. So he was, like we talked about earlier, possibly for a 4 or 5 year stretch, the best player in the National League. And there are a lot of Hall of Famers whom they're Hall of Famers, but you can't say they were the best player in their respective league for that long a period of time. And it just always amazes me to see some of these guys who put up these huge numbers, and they got to be voted into a veterans committee, a special exemption, whatever it is. And when you look back at the career of Jim Bottomley, he's one of these guys, and I just don't get it.
Yeah, I don't either. And I've heard people, you know, today say that he's one of those guys in the Hall of Fame who shouldn't be there. And I don't get that at all. I mean, it's like, really? I mean, I agree that there's some guys who are in there who we might look twice at their resumes.
But yeah.
Really? Jim Bottomley? Because one thing I was thinking about recently is he had the 1422 RBI, and his first and his last seasons in the majors were very short. It was when he was called up early, and then he was basically a pinch hitter and injury riddled his last season. So he basically played 14 full seasons in the majors, and he put up 1400 RBI. And so that's a whole career of 100 RBI a season that he's averaging.
Yeah, that's crazy. That really is crazy. And if you take his 162 game per season average, that's 18 home runs, 116 RBI, and .310 batting average is his average. That's Hall of Fame. I mean, those are Hall of Fame numbers. So what is his legacy? How should Jim Bottomley be remembered?
I think the way I see it, I mean, the Cardinals have different chapters of their history. I mean, today we look back and we see the Cardinals as a great team with a history. He's a foundational piece of that first great Cardinals team. I'm talking from 26 to 31, because by 34, it's not that long later, but that's the Gas House Gang. That's another chapter. But Bottomley is a foundational piece of that 26 to 31 great Cardinals team. And you think about it, the Cardinals won the pennant in 26 by 2 games. They won the pennant in 28 by 2 games. They won the pennant in 30 by 2 games. Take Jim Bottomley off of that roster and all that production we're talking about, I don't think the Cardinals can win any of those pennants without him. And so that totally changes history. You don't have the 26th series with Grover Cleveland Alexander. You don't have a lot of things. And so the Cardinals, I mean, that he is the foundational piece of that first great Cardinals team.
Mm-hmm, no doubt. Hey, when you were writing the book, Sonny Jim Bottomley, How much fun was that? Tell us about that experience.
Oh, it was great. I enjoyed that so much. I mean, the book I wrote before this was a biography of Wahoo Sam Crawford, and I really enjoyed that. And then after that was finished, I was thinking, I really had so much fun writing that. I want to write about another player who, Sam Crawford, like Jim Bottomley, is a great player who is somewhat forgotten. And as a Cardinals fan, I wanted to write about a Cardinal this time. So adding to the positive experience of learning about Jim is I was also immersing myself in Cardinals history. And I start off my books, the first thing I do is I gather the sources. I see what can I find, because, you know, maybe I won't find enough to write a book, but yeah. I did. And so then just kind of putting it together and seeing how the stories emerge and learning about things like the home run hitting the fan in the face I didn't know about, and learning about Jim. They presented him with a cow at home plate near the end of his career to celebrate his career. It's like, I didn't know about that. It's all these crazy little details. And so it was a wonderful experience. I mean, I guess I could summarize it like this: is on one of those days where I was able to just work all day on my book, I was working and working, and then it became time for supper, which, you know, is usually a good time. It's like, I was actually annoyed that I had to stop working on the book to go eat supper.
That's fun. That's great. Well, Ken, I really want to thank you for sharing some of your time with us. Your book, I really enjoyed reading it. Sonny Jim Bottomley, where can people get a copy of it?
Well, my website, kentcross.com, has listings for all of my books. And I would say amazon.com is the most prominent place where people find my books. But any online retailer that sells books would be a place to find them.
Awesome. Ken, again, thanks for joining me on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Many of my guests spend so much time researching and writing about the greats of the game. So if you can, I encourage you to please show them your support. If they've written a book and you like what you've heard, check it out on Amazon. Check it out at any online bookstore, or go to their individual sites and give them a like, write a review, or buy their book. You can check out everything Kent has written on his site, kentkraus.com. And I'm going to have Kent back on Sports Forgotten Heroes to talk about another great figure he has written about, and that's Wahoo Sam Crawford. Hey, thanks again to all of you for listening. And I'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.